This podcast of Snap Judgment is supported by MailChimp. More than 3 million people and businesses use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. MailChimp also distributes hats for cats and small dogs. More at MailChimp.com. Okay, so one night, when I was 5 years old, I was sleeping in a bed right next to my brother. And in the middle of the night, he woke me up and asked, "What's that?" I looked up, and staring down from the ceiling, looking back at us with a child's face, a big forehead like my own, only the face looked like it was made of a red haze. And this face, this boy, he smiled. And I smiled back at him. He leaned closer to us like he was curious or wanted to give us a kiss. He came closer and he finally stopped right in front of my nose. The boy didn't look happy. He didn't seem sad either. I felt my forehead burn and the figure disappear. My little brother said, "I think maybe he's one of us." And I told him, "We don't have another brother." He said, "I think maybe we do. Or maybe we did." And you have to understand that we didn't talk about it that night. We just kept looking up at the ceiling. And when nothing happened, we pulled the covers up and we went back to sleep. We didn't call for a mother or father. We didn't cry. We didn't talk about it to anyone but ourselves, which was strange for us. It wasn't until the next night and the night after that, lying next to each other in the darkness, when we wondered, where did he come from? Where did he go? And when was he coming back? Today on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Spooked 4, The Lost Boys. We've asked real people to tell us their own stories of fighting against that which goes bump in the night. My name is Glenn Washington. Best to turn on the lights and get yourself some company, because you're listening to Snap Judgment. I'm not alone. It is not just me. Everyone I know has a ghost story that they keep in their family. Well, our next story is about an entire family from beyond the veil.
I'm Kathleen McConnell. I live in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm a certified professional secretary. I have been the executive secretary for the presidents of three different corporations in my career.
In 1966, Kathleen McConnell would take the bus every day to one of her earliest secretary jobs at a bank in downtown Louisville. She would pass an old brick house.
The house just had a draw for me, and I could always see this little girl standing in the front window. She appeared to be 10, 11 years old. She would always hold her hand up to the window glass, and I would do the same thing. I thought she was waving at the bus, and I would just hold my hand up to the glass on the bus.
5 years later, Kathleen and her husband were looking to move, and they ended up buying that old brick house. They moved in with their four children including their 8-month-old baby, Duncan.
Well, the first night was uneventful, but the second night, we'd gone to bed a little after 1 o'clock. It was like thunder in the house. Boom, boom, boom. And that's just exactly the way it sounded. And I woke up instantly, but I'm thinking, did I dream that or did I hear that? And then it happened again. Boom, boom. My husband said, did you hear that? I said, well, of course I heard that. What do you think it is? And he said, I don't know, but I'm going to find out. So he slips out of bed, pulls his trousers on, and he gets a handgun that he keeps under the mattress. I think, well, it can't be burglars. Burglars try to keep quiet if they're going to break into a house. So I got out of bed, and I walked down the same hallway to the landing of the steps, and George is standing there, frozen in the spot, and just watching the front door entry. And the inner doors of the house were opening wide and banging against the wall and closing, and opening again and banging the walls and closing. You could see that the outer doors, they were double doors inside and out, but the outer doors were latched down, and then finally it quit. And George and I stood there, and then stoically we just walked back to the bedroom. Didn't say another word. Got into bed. And I lay awake all night, and he went right back to sleep. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to sleep tonight. Something's going on in this house. There's no explanation, but you know it's obvious. You know there's somebody else in your house that you can't see. I knew we'd moved in to a haunted house. The next day, I knew what I had to do, so I went from room to room, asking whoever was there not to hurt my family, not to hurt my children. If they didn't want us there, we wouldn't be there. But we had just sold everything we owned and bought this house. So if there was any way we could live together, we needed to do that. Had anybody seen me, I'd have been carried out with a butterfly net, because I could see myself and the insanity of it.
Throughout the day, she tried to piece together what she knew of this puzzle. She thought of a conversation she'd had earlier with her husband.
That morning, when George came downstairs, he said, did you bring my shoes downstairs? And I said, well, no. And he said, well, I can't find my shoes. And he said, well, I'll wear something else this morning, but while you're picking up the house, see if you can find my shoes. So I said, okay. Well, as I sat there folding diapers, I knew I had yet to go down in the basement, into the cellar. It was a cellar. You had to go outside to get into it. I opened this big, heavy cellar door, and it did allow a little light into the room. It was just a big, big, dark room. It had one light bulb in the center with a chain on it, so I stepped on something squishy. I thought, oh, geez, it's an animal. There's an animal in this cellar. And so I pulled the chain down and looked to see what I had stepped on. And there was George's shoes. I mean, I jumped so fast, I think I missed all the steps and ran back into the kitchen. Realizing then that whomever was in this house, it had to be children. Only children would play a prank like that, because that's a childish prank. They moved the shoes, took them to the cellar. So I sat there a little bit, and then I was elated, really. But that was the first, last, and only time I was ever scared in that house, was before I found out who and what was in it.
She ended up thinking it was most likely a group of kids. Sometimes she felt like there was a baby. Bottles would go missing, toy balls rolled around the floor. Other times, she says it sounded more like a teenager playing basketball in the attic. And she was pretty sure that that girl she used to see in the window was one of these spirit children.
Well, I came to know that there were 3 children in the house. There was a baby. I never did know how old, but I knew it was a toddler. There was a little girl about 10 or 11, and there was a young boy about 13, 14. When you're a mother, and you're already mothering 4 children, and you realize there's another youngster in your house, it's kind of just instinctive that you're going to mother these other children. As the days went on, I would be scolding sometimes, and sometimes I would just be mother. I thought they would come and take me away if they saw me talking to someone that I really wasn't sure was there. The first Christmas we were in the house, I know how ridiculous this sounds, I did buy Christmas presents for these three children. I bought the little girl a makeup case, and I bought perfume that was called Heaven Scent. The baby, the little receiving blanket.
And she bought the one she thought was a boy, a Nerf basketball set, hoping the loud bouncing sound she heard in the attic would quiet down.
Because I thought if he's going to continue to play basketball, he doesn't need to make all that racket.
She brought the gifts, along with a little ceramic Christmas tree, up to the attic.
And so I asked them all to come around me, and I could feel the warmth. It was no longer cold, and I just kind of made in my mind that they had warmed up to me. And so the air was warm. And I gave each one of them their gift, and I set the little yellow blanket beside me, opened it up and flipped it out, and explained it, you know, Duncan has one like this. And as I sat there, I could see the yellow of the little receiving blanket crumple up. So I knew either the baby was crawling on the blanket or the children were sitting on the blanket. But either way, I talked to them and told them about the gifts and about how you play the Nerf basketball. I had one critic to tell me that my story was toothachingly sweet. And she did not believe for 1 minute that I bought Christmas gifts for these children. And I said, well, I didn't tell the story for your benefit.
And then there were times when she thought these spirit children were protecting her own baby.
One evening, I left Duncan in the bathtub, in the upstairs bathroom, while I walked out to the nursery to get Duncan's pajamas. While I'm coming back, this is a deep clawfoot tub, and the water was just pouring into the bathtub like maybe he held on to the faucets and he turned them on higher.
She says she sees both faucets on full steam, filling the tub higher and higher.
But by the time I got in there, Duncan is suspended. He is being held above the water. The water is still rushing into the bathtub. I instantly grabbed my baby, but he is suspended above this water. I knew one of the children was holding Duncan above the water. I went into the bedroom, laid Duncan on the bed, and started drying him off. And I'm still a nervous wreck. I'm shaking all over because I feared for my baby. I could see he would have drowned. And then all at once, the smell of Heaven Scent was around me. Heaven Scent is the perfume I gave the little girl. And all I could do was wrap him in a towel and thank them. I just, thank you, thank you, thank you, you saved my baby.
For the next 5 years, Kathleen acted like a mom to what she called her spirit children in the old brick house. And then Kathleen's mother got sick, and her mom lived out of town and alone.
I knew I needed to take care of my mother. I needed to be next to my mother. We had to move. We had to move. My mother was not well, and I had to have a talk with the children. I think it was the day before we were moving. I had gone up to tell them we had to leave. I always had the meeting place in the attic. I was very emotional, just really trying to get their acceptance and comfort them at the same time. And then just out of the blue, this Nerf ball come and hits me square in the head. And it was like, it'll be okay. It'll be okay. I had to laugh because the Nerf ball just came flying through the attic and hit me square in the head. The morning we were going to, the actual last morning, I had gone through the house and explained everything. And as I did, I heard someone crying. I heard some soft sobs, just soft sobs. And it was like looking through water or looking through smoke. It was the first time that I actually saw these children. The little girl, she was a very pretty little girl. She had the baby on her hip. She had a white nightgown on, and the baby looked like the Gerber baby almost. Little chubby cheeks, and he had a bottle in his mouth, and little blonde hair. And the little boy was slender, a little over 5 feet. Looked like something out of a Charles Dickens novel, actually, because of the way he was dressed. It was good. It was just good. that I was able to see all of them that one morning. People tend to think, if you have an experience like this, you're either a liar or you're a crackpot. I'm here to tell you, there's more in the world than what you can see. I know what happened in that house. And all I can say is, keep an open mind. Just keep an open mind. There's more in the world than what you can see.
Big thanks to Kathleen McConnell for sharing that story with the Snap. You can find a link to her book, Don't Call Them Ghosts, on our website, snapjudgment.org. That story, it was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Renzo Gorio. When Snap Judgment continues, we've got a genie that is not locked in any bottle. The strangest boyfriend you're ever going to hear, and toys that play by themselves. When Snap Judgment, Spook 4, The Lost Boys continues, stay tuned. Hey, Snappers, it's your boy, Glenn. And how long have you wanted to tell the powers that be what you think about Snap? Now is the time. NPR wants to hear what you think about this show, and we need your help to keep things snapping. Check out snapjudgment.org/survey and share your thoughts. Everything you need to know is right there to tell the powers that be what you think about what you hear. snapjudgment.org/survey, and much love from all of us right here at Snap. Peace. Welcome back, Snappers. You've returned to me and your loyalty will be rewarded. So, everyone knows that in the movies, what you do is you get some young, attractive people. You lock them in a house or a lodge, maybe a resort. You play up the sexual tension, keep the atmosphere thick with erotic longing. Then turn out the lights and release the evil spirit. Watch the terror begin. That's how it works in the movies. But what about real life? You see, Mark, Debbie, Christy, and some of their friends were all together one night back in the 80s when suddenly, well, why don't I let Mark tell you the story?
The party really wasn't going anywhere.
It was a combination birthday party and going away party.
The only two people I know there are my friend Christy and our friend Deborah.
Christy and I have been good friends since high school. She has been one of my best friends for years. The party was in an old craftsman's house in Hollywood. Just so you know, I have a very bad memory and I don't remember very much, but I do remember very clearly a lot of this event.
The party was a hodgepodge of various individuals.
My girlfriend Becky was one of my roommates. Becky's boyfriend, Mike, he was a Malibu sheriff. Then there was Mark, the Frenchman, and my girlfriend Debbie. Then my boyfriend Danny, and he was the rocker.
In France, when we had a party, the idea was drink as much as you can, as fast as you can, and then put on James Brown's Sex Machine. Unfortunately, there was no James Brown available that night, so we had to think of something else. And I started to wander off into the dining area, and there was a huge oak table. And in the back, there was an armoire and a bunch of crystal glasses. And, an idea popped in my head, and I thought, hey, there's nothing else going on here tonight. Why don't we do a seance? A long time ago, in my native country of France, there was no toy store where you would find a Ouija board. So we would line up Scrabble letters and cut up a piece of paper that would say yes and one that would say no, and basically improvise a Ouija board. We would turn a glass upside down, we'd put our fingers on top of the glass, and then you concentrate real hard.
It kind of just struck a chord that it would be something fun and different to do.
I kind of thought, whatever, we'll do it. I think in high school, maybe we tried it a couple times, but nothing really ever happened, so I didn't take it seriously and didn't really think anything of it.
I mean, I'm a spiritualist, like, I believe in God, but I don't believe in Ouija boards. I wasn't taking it seriously. I didn't believe in that type of thing at all. So we lit some candles and turned on some, you know, Enya, and just kind of played around.
We cut out a bunch of letters, you know, to create the alphabet, put them around the table in a circle. There was a piece of paper that said yes and a piece of paper that said no. And we took a crystal glass with a stem and turned it upside down and put it in the middle. You know, everybody quieted down and closed their eyes. And I don't know if we are the antennas. I believe we are. And I believe that the glass ultimately is just a vessel and it allows psychic energy to concentrate at the center of it. For those of us who had their fingers on the glass, and I think at the time it was Christy, Deborah, me, and someone else, we started to feel, after a very short amount of time, actually it was uncanny how quickly it started. We started to feel that very familiar little tug.
It was a little bit thrilling, like, ooh, what is this? I remember my hair kind of raising up, thinking, what could this be?
You have the sensation that something is connecting with the glass and then trying to find its bearings. It's very distinctive.
And then after a while, it started kind of getting a flow and a rhythm, and it started kind of moving in an eight, like a shape of an eight, and back and forth, and it was very rhythmic, but it was flowing and very smooth suddenly.
Of course, the skeptics immediately thought, you're moving the glass. And I would say, no, I'm not moving the glass. And a good way to take care of the skeptics is to command the glass to do geometric forms. For example, I would tell the glass to spin in a circle. You tell the glass to go faster and faster and faster. And let me tell you, that thing flies. It's so fast. You cannot coordinate four people that don't know each other, have not rehearsed this, and get a glass to move this fast. It's impossible. At that point, everybody went, huh, what's going on? Now that it was clear that something was moving the glass other than ourselves, one of us asked, who's here?
And started going back and forth to the letter K-I-K-I, or K-E-K-E, I can't remember how it spelled it.
And everybody asked, who's Kiki? And Christy, who was at the head of the table in front of me, just froze. I hadn't ever seen her like that. And she looked down at the table and she said, I know who's here.
I knew it was Brian. Brian had been my boyfriend for about 2.5 years, and he passed after committing suicide. It spelled out K-E-K-E, which is Kiki, which was my nickname that Brian called me just in private. That threw me for a huge loop. That is something that I don't understand to this day. Brian was my first love. I used to think about him every day. I still have not been able to look at pictures of him, but I can still see his face in my head. He was very good looking, had an amazing smile. He kept a tan better than anybody that I ever have seen. Brian was a very lonely, sad person, but most people wouldn't realize that when they met him. When he would walk into a room, everybody was drawn to him, and he was really funny, and he meant the world to me.
I think she was stunned. I think she was pretty shaken up, and I think she, you know, probably quite emotional about it because of the way things had ended.
Brian tried to commit suicide several times, and they put him in a little hospital, and then Christmas came, and I wasn't there, and I wasn't able to speak to him while he was in the suicide watch hospital. But I did find out that he got a belt and wrapped it around his neck and hung himself. A horrible way to die. And he was supposedly under supervision, and they were watching him, and somebody dropped the ball.
Are you in heaven? The glass answered, no. Are you in hell? And the glass answered, no.
We asked him if he was in a place kind of somewhere in between. He said yes. And then Becky asked how long he was going to be there. And he said 27, which is the age he was when he killed himself.
I find myself, like, sometimes, like, I'll get, like, a little tear in my eye, like when I was talking to you, and then I just wipe it away, and it goes away, it dries away.
Christy went to leave to go to the bathroom, and then it stopped moving. We asked this spirit, where'd you go? Did you go with Christy to the bathroom? And it said, yes. And we asked him, okay, if you were there with her, what color underwear was she wearing? And it spelled out, well, it misspelled it, but it said W-I-T-E, white. And sure enough, she was wearing white knickers.
Now, just behind Christy was another guest at the party who was her current boyfriend.
This kind of like glam rock guy sitting around the table, being really cool, not believing any of it.
I mean, what the hell? The ex is showing up uninvited at the birthday party and is getting all the attention. So he started to say, this is bull. And the glass immediately starts to move without having been asked a question. This is unusual. And spelled you. At which point, Christy's boyfriend replied, you.
And the cursor started spelling out his name, D-A-N-I, and then F-U. And it kept going back and forth, D-A-N-I-F-U. You know, you can fill in the blanks, but Danny got very upset.
Now, what's interesting here is that when you have to say something like mother, and you're speaking through a crystal glass as a spiritual entity, it takes a long time to spell M-O, etc., etc.
Danny was getting really upset, and so silly. The Ouija board was getting really upset, which appears to have been Brian picking a fight, if you will, with Danny, my current boyfriend. It was very disturbing.
This is surreal. These two are having a cockfight in two different dimensions.
Danny was very hot-headed and very upset and ended up walking out.
My poor friend Christy was completely devastated. Meanwhile, the glass repeated several times, I love you, and then I'm sorry.
I was just so almost frozen, just paralyzed inside my own head, thinking all these thoughts, you know, is this really him? Why did he die? How come nobody could help him? how much I missed him.
I think that because it was her birthday, we didn't really want to continue. So we said goodbye. And I remember my friend Deborah and I drove back to my house and didn't say a word on the way back.
Ever since that night, I have completely believed. I mean, to me, this was the most proof that there is something out there more than what we can see and what we know. And it's definitely changed the way I see things. And I am the biggest skeptic. I wouldn't believe this story if I weren't there. And I'm sure many people won't believe me, but it happened. And
I feel like he just needed to be heard again. You know, I know this sounds crazy, but I believe he was talking to us. Me.
I think the beauty of his story is not that it is a ghost story, is that it's a love story. And that someone was able to reach beyond the divide and tell someone, for the last time, I love you. Even Romeo and Juliet didn't get that.
Big thanks to everyone who shared their story with The Snap. That piece was produced by Bob Carlson for the program Unfictional at KCRW Santa Monica. We'll have a link to their website at snapjudgment.org. And as Snap Judgment's walk through the dark night continues, we discover what happens when one speaks ill of the dead. Stay right where you are waiting. I promise we will return. Welcome back to Snap from PRX and NPR. This is our fourth installment of the Spook series. Remember to hold someone's hand. Stay close to the light. My name is Glenn Washington, and you've heard someone's old uncle around a campfire telling scary stories in a spooky voice, maybe using that old flashlight trick. Well, that's all well and good. But some stories, they don't need any hype. Our next piece takes place in my old stomping grounds of northern Michigan, where our young friend Keith is attending summer camp.
It is called Camp Hillel. It is an Islamic camp, strictly for Muslims. I'm not sure where exactly in Michigan it is, what city, but it is pretty much in the middle of nowhere, just woods everywhere. I mean, Islam generally supports like oneness with nature. One of the primary activities we generally focused on was lectures from the sheikh, and a sheikh is in Islam, basically what a priest is in Christianity. It wasn't necessarily his main topic of discussion, but he would end the lectures off, I don't want to say warning us, but he said there's been multiple like weird things, I guess, going on in the campsite, and he brought up the topic of jinn. He told us jinn are part of a whole another dimension that we're not able to access. They're generally known to inhabit like secluded areas, you know, separate from like civilization or humans. Like right when it hits sunset, I guess, that's when it's basically their time. They come out, and he told us don't like even think about going into the wooded areas by yourself, because when you show some sort of extreme fear, high levels of vulnerability become like evident towards these jinn. So it's about like 9:30 at night. And you know, we're all coming back to our cabin. Our counselors are with us. We're getting ready for bed at this point. You know, we're all talking. The door to our cabin, the front door, the entrance, starts opening and closing continuously for like 3 minutes, and I mean, it's basically impossible for the wind to blow it in. This door, every time it closes, you know, there's a latch. I know this one kid, I look at him, and his face is just white. He's just like sweating very intensely, and he starts screaming like, "What the hell is going on? What the hell is going on?" He was crying, man. Like, and everybody's telling him to calm down. So you need to relax yourself. Like, this is gonna stop in a second. I swear, I get shivers telling you this, man. He's out of his bed. He's on his knees, leaning towards the ground, and dude, just like that, man, his head just starts swinging back and forth. On his knees, the back of his head would touch the ground. He'd lean forward, go back, back of his head would touch the ground again, and he did this repetitively for about like 10 seconds. When this is happening, while he's going back and forth, he starts vomiting just viciously, man. Like, it was disgusting. I've never seen vomiting like at such a rapid rate. It seemed ridiculously excruciating. Our counselor gets the camp doctor, and they grab this kid. They put him onto the bed, and he starts going crazy. And this is when I realized, like, all right, there is something wrong with this kid. I think he's freaking possessed. He's just tossing them off of him, man. Like, swinging with his fingers, clawing them. They're trying to contain him by basically putting, like, extreme pressure on his forehead. He's screaming, "Anablis, Anablis," which means, "I am the devil." Iblis, in Islam, is considered the devil, you know, that is the name of the devil. He wasn't gagging, he was moaning, like, it was a moan of pain, echoing, you know, just like, "Anablis." It was a very dark, dark sort of tone. And, I mean, I know this all seems very superstitious, and we all thought, okay, maybe he's legit having a panic attack. But yet, the atmosphere of the cabin itself was so thick and dark and very murky that we knew, man, that this kid had a jinn inside of him. He's clawing at them, he's screaming, "Anablis, Anablis." So the counselor, you know, he leaves Rani and us there, and he goes and gets the sheikh, okay, the sheikh of the camp. Now the sheikh bolts in. This is about 2 minutes later, you know, after he left. He bolts in to the cabin, and instantly, dude, no further explanation was required. He saw what was going on, and he knew right away. And in this situation, it's known in our religion that there's a specific verse you have to recite. It is a verse called Ayat al-Kursi. Ayat al-Kursi. From this one chapter in the Quran, which is our holy book. This sheikh, you know, he starts reciting Ayat al-Kursi. He's reading. I'm like, dude, what? This is supposed to drive the spirit out of the human body, but yet he's still going crazy, screaming anablis. So after about like 5 minutes of reciting, man, he starts vomiting again. Not as he was before, you know? It's kind of like normal vomit, you know? After he stops vomiting, dude, he lets out this, like, demon-like screech. It was so deep and powerful. It was unlike anything I've ever heard. So he lets out this screech, and it just became silent, man, just silence. As weird as this sounds, man, like, instantly, I swear to God, the air just, you can feel it. It started to clear up. They rush him to the hospital. The sheikh hops in with him, the counselor, and the doctor. They all go with. I'm sitting there, dude, I'm not gonna lie. I'm bawling. I'm just, like, crying my ass off. When they got back, they had told us the doctors were very confused. If he was having like a panic attack or an anxiety attack, his blood pressure and his heart rate would be through the roof. But this kid, he had a heartbeat that was pretty much unnoticeable. He left the hospital probably 2 or 3 days later. I've seen him one time since that incident. And I'll tell you one thing, man, he will never be the same, ever. Nowhere near the kid he used to be. He's, I mean, I guess very introspective, but to the point where he doesn't say anything. And when he does say anything, it's kind of something irrelevant, definitely in his own world. I mean, honestly, man, I believe that when you become possessed, you know, I told you that the humans and the jinn dimension, they can contact us, but we can't contact them. But this kid literally has opened up this dimension in his own way. Like, and you know, I've never asked him to elaborate on this because honestly, man, I don't want to hear any more about it. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I've developed some sort of phobia towards this whole topic of jinn. The next year, they had changed the campsite, you know, they decided to never go back there. You know, they've never gone back since, man.
Thank you so much, Keith, for sharing your story with The Snap. That piece was produced by Anthony Briones, with sound design by Stephanie Fu. Now, in my house, we have a crawl space. It's a dirt room that under no circumstances will I venture into because that's where all the bad things live. But what happens when whatever's in the bad space decides to go wandering? We ask Gary Jansen for his story.
It was a cold night, and my wife asked me to go upstairs to get a pair of socks out of my son's room. It was a dark room. There was a nightlight on. As soon as I walked in, I felt like there was a presence or a person standing behind me. So instinctively, my shoulders went up, and I turned around quickly, but there was nothing there. I'd never felt something like this before, and the only way I can describe it as if someone had an electric glove and was rubbing the length of my back, and I had this surge of strange, for better lack of a better word, electrical shock kind of going through my body. And when it was done, I left the room, walked downstairs, and would have forgotten about the experience had it not happened the next day, and then a day after that. And then the following day. There were strange noises started happening in the house. We had electrical anomalies happening. There were chills in places where there shouldn't have been chills. I was resistant to the idea that something supernatural could be happening. And then something started happening with my son's toys, those ones that are battery operated. And in the middle of the night, these cars would just turn on. One night, my wife and I are sitting in the living room, and there's a Frosty the Snowman doll in the middle of the room just sitting there. My son's asleep. And out of nowhere, the thing starts singing the Frosty the Snowman song.
Frosty the Snowman is a fairy tale they say. He was made of snow, but the children know how he came to life one day.
I'm unnerved. I thought maybe this is just my imagination. Maybe it's just stress, you know? Maybe I was sick. It took me about a year of event stacking on top of event before I finally just gave myself over to the idea that maybe something out of the ordinary, something extraordinary, something supernatural was happening in the house. So I reached out to an expert, Marianne Winkowski. She's able to do readings, or she's able to tell just over the phone whether or not your house is haunted. I had mixed feelings about calling Marianne Winkowski, only because it seemed that I was going a bit over the edge. I thought she was going to be perfectly honest, I thought she was going to be cuckoo. She knew nothing about me. She did not know the story. I did not give her any information. But she began to be really precise on the layout of the house. Is this happening in your son's room? Well, yes, it was happening in my son's room. She asked if the room where the things were happening was yellow. Yes, it was a yellow room. That started to give me a little bit of a chill. And then she said, you have a young man who just is in the house for about a year. And I could feel, as she's talking to me, I could feel that that sensation go through my body. And she says, Gary, he's right on top of you right now. Well, it freaked me out. Well, she said that he wasn't very happy with me. And she kept asking about the name Merrick. I didn't know anybody named Merrick, so it wasn't anybody I knew. But there was a faint memory where that word, that name, had importance. Within time, I realized that there may have been a connection to this man, which I would never, never in a million years would have imagined. There's a very familiar article about a young man, not named Merrick, but a young man named Peter Smith, who was from Merrick. Merrick was a neighboring town, who died in March of 2007 from a severe car accident. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that I had actually read that article when it had happened back in March of 2007. The experience began in our house the day I read that article, because I had done something that I normally don't do, having read that article. From the article, it seemed that he'd been irresponsible and was racing around and ended up killing himself and injuring someone else and almost killing that person. And I remember just calling out loud, what the hell were you thinking, you idiot? And I was berating this man who I had never met before. I was just had read in an article who just died. And after thinking about that, I began to connect these dots. Did my response to this man, my vitriol, did he somehow hear it? It sounds so silly, but I think I surrendered myself to the possibility that these coincidences that were occurring had some kind of meaning to them. I didn't really feel frightened. I felt sad. I felt sad about my reaction to him. I felt sad for what had happened to him in life. All that being said, I did not want Peter Smith or the ghost in the house. Eventually, Marianne was able to direct me in a way to get the spirits to move on to a funeral home. If there was a funeral going on, what you could do is then push the spirit to that funeral, and that opening to the next world would be there. And it just happened that I lived across the street from a funeral home, Mackin Mortuary. So one day I'm walking home from work and I see that the funeral home actually has people coming in and out of it. I ran home, busted into the house and said, come this way, walked them to that door. And as I turned to walk away, the front door of the funeral home opened. There was a man there that said, hey, can I help you? And it was one of the funeral directors. I think I replied that, yeah, I just wanted to see if you're open. And they said, yes, we are. And I went, good, okay. So I went home afterwards and told my wife what I had done. And we went to bed. And the strangest thing happened the next day. When we woke up, the house was quiet. There was a change in the house. And it was as if there had been a white noise machine on in our house for we don't know how long, and that someone had turned it off. It was a welcome silence. It was a silence of peace.
Okay, so we're a little bit freaked out over here at the Snap. Even as we're working on this story where strange forces inhabit other things, the file we were working on mysteriously deleted itself. We scrambled to reconstruct this story and it deleted itself again. This has never happened before, ever. So if something were to occur between now and broadcast, I'm not saying that it's related to spirit activity, but I do want the record to reflect that I, Glenn Washington, am speaking ill of no one, either living or deceased. Do you understand that, you deceased people? Big thanks to Gary Jansen for that story. Find a link to Gary's book on our website, snapjudgment.org. That story was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Pat Massini Miller. now then. You can unclench your fist, breathe that sigh of relief, pretend nothing really happened. We're going to have all four Snap Judgment spooked episodes awaiting your pleasure on our website, snapjudgment.org. While you're there, check out the podcast, the movies, the pictures, the stuff. Facebook, when we feel like it. Twitter, when we want to. The Snap was produced by myself in the most frightening freak fest in Frankentown. Wrap your hands in toilet paper for the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat and C.D. Miller hears beats from beyond the grave. Anna Sussman only drinks the blood of vegans. Stephanie Fu is not so discriminating. Julia DeWitt sleeps under the earth. Nick Vanderkolk can see dead people. Renzo Goriel carries a fork around for no apparent reason, and Will Urbina says he doesn't believe. Now, have you ever found dead animals left on your porch and wonder from whence they came? No, it wasn't the neighbor's cat. It was from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting trying to let you know what's what. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, exchanging members of the public for other members of the public until there is no more public. PRX.org. And you know, this is not the news. No way is this the news. Even if we found out that something evil, something dark, something sinister was growing and building and threatening to envelop the globe in its dark power, even then, that would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is